Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Wabanaki Windows is being brought to you by WERU in East Orland, Maine, in partnership with WMPG Portland, Maine. Today we will discuss the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act from a very different global, historic, and economic perspective. I'm calling this series Hidden Elements. The Land Claims Act was signed into law in 1980. It is a document that presently defines our relationship with the state. Our guests today are very familiar panelists, Professors Harold Prince and Distinguished Professor of Anthropology and Emeritus at the University of Kansas, Professor Darren Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation and Professor of Anthropology and Chair of the Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Welcome to the show, everyone. I wanted to look at the land claims through a very different Wabanaki window. I've always thought that there was more to land claims historically and economically. Today, we will look at the land claims through the eyes of one of the opposition attorneys, John Patterson. He was in the intro. He says in the intro to his article that he was the state's lead attorney in charge of the state's defense. We will use his Historical Society article titled The Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act, A Personal Recollection, published in 2012. It clarifies what the state of Maine was thinking about this land claims and what they see as their legal arguments. Let's see where that leads us, and we'll be talking about the land claims and the economic implications to Maine and the large landowners and the tribes. I want to start with, we'll start to look at this article. I want to ask, Professor Ranko, what you thought, Darren, of this article when you read it.
Thanks, Donna. Great to be joining you and Harold once again. It's interesting because I hadn't, this is from a 2012 article in the journal Maine History. And I guess, you know, as a document, it represents, you know, where the state was coming from. And I think it underscores some of the frameworks that they're using. I think most surprising is it's funny after it's funny to see this come out in 2012 and that he still carries with him that opinion that it felt like, you know, some in the state had at the time, and obviously as the lead negotiator attorney for the state, that questions the fundamentals of the case, and does so in a way that I think is more of a political, I mean, it's surprising that it got published because I think there's some historical errors in this, including things like, you know, and his understanding of the Non-Intercourse Act from 1790, which was the legal sort of justification for the land claims, that there were treaties made with states after 1790, which the Non-Intercourse Act says that only treaties with Indian tribes are only to be made with the federal government. So that's the basis of the claim, which I've called, therefore, these are illegal treaties. They violate this federal law. He seems to question that law and by saying that these were sort of just land concessions and not, or contracts, not treaties. But he makes a dubious claim there, for example, that because unlike out in the West where treaties in the 19th century were to settle hostilities and sort of ongoing warfare, that's what those treaties were about, which is factually untrue. I mean, there's so many of the treaties in the Western part of the U.S. that had nothing to do with ongoing wars or hostilities. So, and he says through his historical research, which is ironic because there's just no way that history holds up by in any serious scholarly sense. But I think that position that there's just this sort of there's no kind of basis for this, and almost painting the state as a kind of victim or like he ignores the ongoing pieces that we've looked at here, for example, of just basic, fraud and theft, like over the 150, 160 years between 1820 and 1980. So he's able to kind of paint this like, we did nothing wrong. This was just an inheritance that we just had from these like agreements. He also states, and I think you were pointing this out, Donna. I think you had pointed it out before we started recording, that there was that the provisions of these treaties and the responsibility to them was consistently printed in the Constitution in the 20th century, and that's factually wrong, as we know, in terms of the push recently we've had to restore those provisions, which the state of Maine has in respect to its promise to uphold the terms of those treaties. And what I think is also interesting is that they don't call in the state constitution, they don't call them whatever he calls them, contracts of accession or whatever, though they're referred to as agreements, treaties, and other provisions agreed to in previous. So the treaty language is in that part of the extinguished parts, the non-printing parts of the Constitution that started in the 1870s. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting framework to wrestle with in terms of what he's trying, to say. I wonder, I often wonder about the economic interests involved. As we've pointed out before, without there were no state monies, right? There was no sort of admission of fault in the Settlement Act. This is like completely a federal bailout of an issue that the state had to deal with. And he does go into the part of the pieces that I think are sort of enlightening in this piece would be. He goes into this bond issue that really took caught the attention. So the ability of those issuing bonds to guarantee that the bonds were, represent, a clear interest or free from any other claims, that this forced the economic issue for the state in terms of the Passamaquoddy v. Morton case, and then the subsequent Department of Interior kind of representing the tribes and going forward with some elements of the land of a potential land lawsuit, which led to the Settlement Act. So I think there are some things that, at least in understanding that, like it's been written about elsewhere, but I would say some of the that's an interesting understanding of what was motivating the state. I mean, always as we've even recapitulated in this framework. Always the sort of protecting of land interests, the protecting of financial interests that had been built upon by, seizing our lands as Wabanaki people and sort of protecting those interests. So I think it, if I were to say anything good about it would be some of those pieces. But otherwise, I find some really alarming historical flaws in the argument.
Yeah, and before Harold, before I let you talk, I was going to say something at the beginning of this, and I forgot to mention it, and it's in his when he makes an introduction to his article, he says the and I quote, "The creation of a unique jurisdictional arrangement under which the state would reign substantial legal authority over tribal lands and members that the state had lost as a result of the Maine Law Court decision in 1979, State v. Dana. As a result, Maine stands alone among states in that it has substantial legal jurisdiction over Indian tribal lands and members. So he wanted to make that point before he even started his article. So that being said, Harold?
Yeah, one of the things that become interesting about the timing of the publication of this article, in other words, you get here a text that comments on the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act of 1980 and the Deputy Attorney General's personal recollection of how that federal law came into being gets pretty much an uncontested perspective in the pages of the Maine Historical Society journal, Maine History, of which I'm serving on the editorial board. I had not seen that manuscript when it was vetted, refereed for publication. But in hindsight, it's just fascinating to see that the Attorney General's office under, I think it was Attorney General Schneider, who came into a dispute about the sovereignty over the Penobscot River. There's a collusion, you could call it, a collusion between this Maine state authority and, in this particular case, the Maine History Journal as a organ from the Maine Historical Society, whereby a former lawyer and then a partner of a law firm who is itself, if I'm not mistaken, repeatedly involved in litigation issues, gets to say the word in, without inviting a counter perspective in the pages of the Maine History Journal in order to balance minimally the perspective of this personal memory by the Deputy Attorney General. So in other words, there's a seamless, literally a seamless, because of the 2012 date, between this article reflecting on 1980 and what preceded that, and his perspective on what was achieved and how to interpret those achievements and the legality and historical truth of those, and the setting the stage of a subsequent litigation in federal court that minimally has influenced if the district federal judge had done minimally some basic homework, would have read this article and might have prejudiced the federal judge of the district court in Maine against the tribe in its litigation about the sovereignty of the Penobscot River. And I find it very troubling on many levels, because other than what Darren just said and what you just said, Donna, there are many flaws in this article, not only in terms of misreading about what treaties are, and Darren correctly pointed out, there are many reasons for treaties that have nothing to do with surrender on the part of the tribe, but also the assertion of sovereignty on the part of the sovereigns in Europe. In other words, the monarchs in Europe, the crown in England, for example, when it makes a claim about Aboriginal title, that has nothing to do with the inherent sovereignty claims by Indigenous nations who have a claim to ancestral lands that doesn't need the approval or disapproval of a palace character in London or in Whitehall in order to determine who owns the land, that those things have to be settled. In other words, the presumptions that are being made about historical rights to ancestral lands, the right to self-government and self-determination, which are the key pillars of sovereignty, that is simply brushed away under a misinterpretation, or rather, I should say, an incomplete biased interpretation of what Aboriginal title is. So this is deeply troubling because it reflects a colonial mindset. And when people talk about decolonization, right, decolonization also extends to the history books, because those histories are becoming embedded in legal opinions and become subsequently embedded in laws that you then have to contend with the very presuppositions that are in dispute. And finally, regarding the treaties in Maine, it should be pointed out that indigenous ambassadors like Saguarab, Laurent Saguarab, a good example, in the negotiation of the so-called Dummers Treaty that ended a genocidal war against the Wabanaki nations, when he finds out that his words were translated in a way that were not reflecting what he had actually said, and he did hardly know any English, so they relied on interpreters who were themselves not lawyers and who chose language that then becomes embedded in a treaty language that did not reflect at all what Saguarab had agreed to. So he feels very angry when he finds out, when he gets a translation back from English into Penobscot, when he finds out what he supposedly had agreed to, which was not what he had agreed to. In other words, the whole foundation of these treaties that I know, Donna, you've been long for a long time, you've been very interested in, whether it was the Treaty of Portsmouth, the Dummers Treaty, you name it, all these treaties in the six Anglo-Wabanaki Wars, all of those treaties have to be looked at with great suspicion, because none of which survive, as far as I know, in any of the Wabanaki languages. We have an English text only. That's unheard of if you look at the European disputes that got settled by treaty. You have legal experts on both sides, let's say a French-English treaty, in order to find out whether the language corresponds exactly to what it states in French and in English, but we don't have that for the Wabanaki. In other words, the Wabanaki are repeatedly crippled in their efforts to get justice in the courts.
Darren.
Yeah, I was just looking again because I thought this was the case. So he references this case, State v. Dana, which is a recognition of our inherent sovereignty pre-settlement act. And it relies upon the framework of the non-intercourse. It relies upon Passamaquoddy v. Morton in many ways, but it also so therefore recognizes that not only land, but also sort of an ongoing relationship between the federal government and the tribes here in what is now Maine. What's interesting, so our buddy here is listed as the lead attorney for the state in this case. And it's funny because I feel like this article is him trying to relitigate basically a series of points he made in the court case that were dismissed by the judges, and for many of the same reasons we're saying, like that it makes no sense. There's no reason to believe that that's what treaties are. There's no reason to believe that this is only for Western Indian. Like, they dismiss each of his points that are in this main history article. It'd be interesting to have sort of put as an addendum to this article, maybe Harold and I can write in and just print this opinion as a rebuttal to the points, because it goes through each of the frames that he puts forward and how they're sort of wrong legally, not only just historically. Like they in order to come to the decision that in fact independent Indian communities, which was the language of concern in the State v. Dana case, that for all these reasons, and with the Passamaquoddy v. Morton decision, it only follows that it makes sense that our tribal lands and our jurisdictions are like the rest of the tribes that have recognized authority through retained sovereignty and, you know, domestic dependent nation status as recognized in Supreme Court decisions since the 1820s and 1830s. So it's an interesting rebuttal. But I mean, he gets to then write this article, I guess, that's published by a journal, and he can not even allude to the fact that most of the same points he's making in this article were dismissed by judges in 1979. So I think it's an interesting kind of thing. Maybe that's the personal reflection. Like, you get to relitigate a case without anyone on the other side or anyone judging your arguments. And maybe that's what the personal piece of this is. I mean, it's such a, and if you look at the volume of Maine history that it appears in volume 46, number two, the theme of the journal for that volume number is land and labor, which I'm just trying to support what I think Harold's saying, which is it feels like he was putting this in this a print in a journal. How it got through there, maybe we will never know, but in support of this position by the state. And so, because if you read some of the frameworks of the state's response in the Passamaquoddy, in the Mills, Penobscot Nation Mills case, and it started out as the Schneider case, but it echoes a lot of what Patterson was putting forward, both in his loss in the 1979 case and then this article as well. So.
He says something, I think Harold might take offense to this. Like, Harold's taken offense to the whole article anyway. But on was it page 200, 201, he says the anthropological evidence consisted of imprecise tribal tales, nearly 200 years from the modern day events. So he was he said that in the context that, this happened 200 years ago. Why are we getting sued now?
Well, it's actually a total misrepresentation of the position that the expert witnesses on the part of the tribes argued. That was not a historical tales, right? As if this is kind of a hearsay folklore. The major expert witness was Dean Snow, a former professor at the University of Maine and an archaeology specialist who, at that time, I believe, was the dean at the State University of New York in Albany, and is now a professor emeritus of Penn State University, a highly respected, one of the superbly respected scholars, specialist on the Northeast, and the author of a chapter in the so-called Handbook of North American Indians in the volume of Northeast, published by the Smithsonian. So to dismiss Dean Snow's perspective as this kind of folkloric memory is insulting, to say the least. What is interesting, though, is that he seems to rely heavily on another report, the expert witness for the state of Maine, who was a history professor at the University of Maine in Orono, Ronald Banks. And Ronald Banks, I respect posthumously very highly for his acumen as an historian. He was very good, like Dean Snow was very good. Both were very good. They marshaled the evidence to the best of their abilities. The case of Ronald Banks was literally a mortal blow for the state because he was killed in New Orleans outside of his hotel. There was a robbery, and I remember when I was in New Orleans a few years later at a conference, I was very aware of the tragic fate that Ronald Banks had. The other supporting people in the state of Maine were Edwin Churchill of the an historian at the Maine State Museum, and Bruce Burke, state archaeologist and at that time a senior lecturer at Bates College. And his position, Burke's position, has been pretty consistent in terms of there's probably no other word for it than the idea that the Indian tribes in Maine are, in essence, not tribes at all. And how he came to that conclusion, and I at the time knew him quite well in the 1980s, was by creating a biographical database and then projecting on what he thought a tribe should be. And that was this kind of romantic, isolated notion that that everybody was born and raised and died as a penobscot, bypassing the idea that in the Wabanaki Confederacy there were intermarriages between the tribes that solidified and augmented the diminishing tribal populations because they were forced to marry out. And he basically looked at the data of sharply reduced tribal communities that had been the victims of genocide and epidemic diseases, that when they married out for both romantic reasons, perhaps, but also for political reasons, that Penobscot married Pessamquoddy, married Maliseet, married Mi'kmaq, married Abenaki, that somehow was a reason why these tribes were no longer tribes, because they had intermarried with other tribes or with non-Indian people even. And none of these arguments, of course, would hold water but with any comparison with any state in Europe, or let alone the United States of America, which is a nation of immigrants. By that definition, the United States has no right to call itself a nation at all. So you get these kind of superimpositions of ideas about what is a tribal community that is so bereft of a true understanding of humanity, which perhaps is the result when you're only dealing with arrowheads and skeletons and archaeological artifacts that you dig up in shell heaps, where you don't have anyone talking back to you about however you may interpret those data. But anyway, the problem is that the state of Maine relied on Ronald Banks, solid historian. Edwin Churchill was really not a specialist on this material at all. He was a silversmith specialist and wrote something about fisheries and so on, was a wonderful curator at the museum. And then Bruce Bourke, who was an archaeologist who, for some reason, dove into ethnohistory that he was not really professionally and academically prepared for to handle.
Right, so the state, there were a couple of lawsuits, right? There was the State v. Dana and was it Passamaquoddy v. Morton case?
Yeah, that was the, you're right, that was the.
Yeah, so those two cases kind of put some fear into the state because they didn't want to lose their jurisdiction over the tribes and over tribal members, which I found kind of strange, but because as Harold and you all were saying, is that, you know, they looked at the tribes as not being tribes, but as being just regular Maine citizens, nothing special about them, except for their living together in communities, tribal communities. They're not really sovereign entities. So they wanted to take away that view that these were tribes, because if they could do that, what would happen is that they would have no obligations whatsoever to these tribes. They wouldn't owe anything. And they could go about their business and not worry about money being paid out from the state to the tribes because of their treaty obligations. The thing that really got them was this, the losing their jurisdiction, losing their power over these tribes. And so what they insisted on before they would even negotiate is that there would be no money paid by the state in the suit, and that they would negotiate for jurisdiction, which was not even part of the land claims that the tribe was interested in. So the state basically said, hey, you know, we're not gonna negotiate until you agree that we're not gonna have to pay money and that we're gonna maintain our jurisdiction. So they, to me, that solidifies everything that we've been talking about in our past shows. And it shows how desperate they were, because they could see their grip and control of the tribe losing that grip. So Harold, you look like you're gonna say something.
What's interesting is, I should, let's say, first and foremost, I'm not a lawyer nor a legal historian. So I am a little bit reluctant to get too deep into the jurisdictional legal issues. That is really not my brief, so to speak. But what I do find interesting is, in all these cases, is the shadowy role of the paper companies and their lobbyists. I just found in a series of notes that I made in 1982, when I was working with Mi'kmaq on the federal recognition case and land claims for the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaq. I, at that time, realized that they had been left out from the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act that abolished all claims to Aboriginal title by any tribe, and that left, of course, the Mi'kmaq into the cold. But I made I typed out, and if you don't mind if I read that, this is from 1982, typed out in my notebook, because this pertains to the issues that we talk about. The Maine Indian tribes claimed millions of acres in northern Maine, but eventually settled for 300,000 acres. While the state of Maine persistently refused to give up one single acre to the tribes, the paper companies were very eager to sell the federal government their land, which is then going to be given to the two tribes. However, the paper companies were anything but generous and did not like the 1978 Carter proposal through the White House negotiator Judge Gunter, which suggested $5 an acre. 12 large paper and pulp companies were eager to sell, but under their own conditions and price. Knowing that the tribes had a strong legal case, they drove their price up from the $5 to $100 to $110 per acre in 1978, 1979, to $182 in 1980. The paper companies had a strong lobby, both in the Maine Senate and House, predominantly the Republican legislatures, as well as in Washington. Much pressure behind the political scene was exercised to force certain congressmen, such as the Republican chairman of the House Budget Committee, Representative Hartford, Connecticut, to play along. Mr. Guillamo's supporters in the Hartford area had intricate links with the Maine paper companies and stood to gain from the generous deal these companies and shareholders were going to gain the quick settlement of the claims by Maine's two tribes. That's from my, and that goes on. This is just the beginning of my never published rough notes, where I tried to understand, what exactly was going on in the settlement of a federal law that appears to become then an issue of justice. I should also say, just before I continue, before you continue, I'd like to just insert something, that a big hallmark was the transition from Gerry Ford's administration to Jimmy Carter's administration, because all these pieces were into place when Gerry Ford was still president. And the date of 1976 looms very largely, because that was the bicentennial. And so there was kind of a political pressure on the White House and on the US Congress to deal with, that was also, of course, the commemoration of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which was the first centennial, 1876. So you get this stream from 1776, the Declaration of Independence, to 1876, the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which was lost by the cavalry and won by the Plains Indian tribes, then to 1976, when in Maine, but also in upstate New York with the Oneida Nation and the rest of New England with the Narragansett and the Wampanoag, for example, there was a lot of these claims regarding the Non-Intercourse Act challenge. So it's a very complicated theater that is going on there in the 1970s that really this article that we are discussing now has no eye for whatsoever.
I think the common thread in what you were just talking about is land. And I think that in Maine, Patterson on page 217 of his article mentions that Dead River Company was the principal land owners. And the fact that the state sort of didn't get involved with these land negotiations, he was He wanted to make that clear that the state had nothing to do with these land negotiations, that the tribe went off to the side and negotiated the land deals with these land companies. And the other thing he says is the selling landowners would have their sales treated as if they were forced sales, eminent domain, thereby avoiding capital gains taxes. So they thought of everything with this land stuff. And it seems like they're not even, trying to hide this. So you know that there was lots of money being made with this land.
No, it's so just to, I want to go back to page 201 again and thinking about, what's good for me is not for thee, or whatever the framework. Harold gave a nice overview of Bork's notion of an Indian tribe and how that would fall apart immediately for any other group of people in human history. In terms of this, single progenitor line of nationhood. It's interesting that they often conflate these things only in the context of Indian tribes, it seems, especially these days, that referencing this idea of anthropological evidence and, a few hundred members and 12 million acres, but no one says if a billionaire owns a million acres that they're just not using it well enough, therefore it should be seized by the state. It's only this weird notion, this Lockean notion of property ownership, of improvement, is only actually kind of brought into consideration with Indians, it seems, anymore, that they're not properly using it, therefore we take it. They're not fully using it, therefore we have a right to it. And that's simply just not even legally, of course, that's not what these cases legally are about. And there's nowhere in the Non-Intercourse Act that says, oh yeah, the treaties will be null and void if we think that, although this does, some elements of this framework does become part of federal Indian law at a later point after the Non-Intercourse Act. But this idea that if tribes aren't using the land in the right way, it should be seized, or it's for too many people, or too few people, and too much acreage. So I don't. That's not how land is conceived in these contexts, or a treaty seized, treaty seized lands, or whatever. But it also makes me think about just this sort of moving of the goalpost, kind of ever present in this work, even. Which I think is interesting that he does at least admit that very few people representing the state have actually politically and even legally admitted that these cases existed in, like the State v. Dana case existed prior to the Settlement Act, because there's all this legislative record around the Settlement Act, which says that it would be considered to be an enhancement of tribal sovereignty. So that's in the legislative record. And then often the state's political position is that, oh, there's all this like help with that. The Settlement Act doesn't diminish sovereignty. It helps it along, or whatever. It gives the land base, that sort of thing. But I mean, he rightfully admits to the fact that they saw these cases as a threat. So again, that this is this fear of tribal sovereignty, and where it comes from, though, is it's only just viewed as a threat. Like he, like any of the people who are against our sovereignty now in the legislature or in the governor's office or in the AG's office, they don't actually follow through on what drives the fear, right? They don't connect the dots for us. So that's why we have to have these episodes, Donna, right? They're never like that honest. I mean, this is as honest you'd see as someone being, right? That this was we were worried about this, and thank God they took care of it, and the Settlement Act was kind of his position. But they never say exactly why, right? So why the threat? Why is our threat? Why is our sovereignty, our inherent sovereignty, such a threat to their interests? And that's why we're forced to make, you know, informed theories around the fear, because we see it as the Harvard Report and so many other examples. We see vibrant tribal sovereignty helping with the economic and other issues of non-native citizens who are nearby these tribes. So they have to ignore that, right? They have to sort of say, like, an enhanced, you know, a normal tribal sovereignty framework would harm us in some way, and that they don't have to say how the harm, what the harm would be, right? They because perhaps it's not a harm that is politically easily articulatable, right? That is like just about protecting moneyed interests in, you know, the development of a potential mine, say in the Penobscot watershed. Or, you know, I think this idea that in and of itself, tribal sovereignty is a threat that we've been living with, the rhetoric we've been living with, which I think has very racist undertones and overtones since the, you know, since the beginning of the state of Maine, but as a rise against this, our interests as tribes, right from the beginning of the Settlement Act negotiation, the court cases, how it gets represented in the press, how almost every political person ran against, you know, Democrat, Republican, it didn't matter, right? They all ran against the Settlement Act and our rights. You know, it was a populist position, right? To say, I'm for every Mainer, not for this special thing with Indians. And I think that, you know, obviously that discourse has changed, that for that it's now the progressives in the state that see it, the flaws in that. But that wasn't always the case. The progressives in the 70s and 80s were not our friends. And we're not kind of playing ball in that way then either. So I feel like this, like, constantly moving the goalposts and sort of meaning what they say and why they say it and why the threat. I mean, I think of it as like, when you ask, like, I can always get through the, you know, I can always ask at least one or two questions of someone who's like against our sovereignty. And then the conversation stops because they actually don't have an answer to the third question, right? So it's like, oh, why are you against this? So it's like, oh, I have questions, you know, it seems like too much, too fast, or I have questions, it might be unclear. We're like, oh, why, what is it that you have that's unclear? Well, I don't know. It just feels very unclear. You know, this is like people who have never thought about, you know, if the position is, we need to negotiate these things one by one over a long period of time, or we don't want it to go too fast. I mean, these were the precise reasons at the federal level people didn't want the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, right? They were always saying, you're wanting too much too fast, and we need to negotiate one little piece of this each at a time. That was always the position against it by the 1960s. It wasn't like, oh, we don't recognize a claim. It was more like, just wait, you know, just, your rights can wait. It can be negotiated one by one over a period of time. So I just feel like this representation of like the moving the goalposts and sort of what people recognize and when is another lens through this article, right? So it was like kind of like trying to put all those pieces on the table.
You know, I think it was very, I don't know, interesting. It even made things clearer in some respects, because he says, you know, during the testimony, legislative testimony about this land claims at the Civic Center, Flanagan gets up and Flanagan says, by treating Indian Territory as municipalities, this settlement provides that our Indian citizens will be on substantially equal footing with their fellow citizens in other towns for the first time in Maine history. So it is accurate to state there has been no compromise of the state sovereignty at all. What we have created is certainly not a nation within a nation, but rather two new municipalities within the state. Lanigan. Now, Tureen comes back, and Tureen says, the tribes opened negotiations with the state concerning the question of jurisdiction, not because they wanted to do so, but because they were obliged to do so to obtain a settlement that they had already negotiated with the federal government. So, and then it says the intent of the law was to avoid a possible preemptive effect of any federal legislation that delegated federal regulating power to Indian tribes. And he's talking about the law that said that, you know, it wouldn't preempt federal Indian law. So anyway, I just thought I'd put that in there. That kind of opened my eyes to a few things too. Harold?
Darren was several times referring to, and I'm hopefully quoting him correctly, moving the goalposts. That is an important term because a term that we have used in earlier interviews on your program, Donna, is the concept of structural power. The capacity to move a goalpost is directly related to the concept of structural power. In other words, who sets the rules of the game on the field in which the tribes are being invited or where they challenge their opponents? Who makes the rules? Who are the arbiters? And what you see then is that the capacity to move the goalpost is in the hands of the state of Maine or the federal government, but very rarely in the hands of the tribes. They have to be fought. Every foot and every inch of that movement in their advantage has to be fought over very, very hard with enormous numbers of resources that the tribes usually don't have. So what is unique in many ways that the state of Maine, when in its collaboration with the paper companies, began to realize that, as Darren and you have frequently pointed out, that the feds could pay out basically the paper companies and the state of Maine for all kinds of issues that the state of Maine was not willing to pay for. It was a clever deal that was worked out, much of which behind the scenes, and is certainly not reflected in this article. In other words, John Patterson knows a lot more that if he had been an unbiased historian and a witness to history, which he was, he would not have written this self-serving article. So that's comment number one. Comment number two is related to the concept of structural power, is the concept of paradigm. And that gets again back to what Darren was talking about, namely, how do people frame an issue? How do they see it? How do they theorize, argue, and muster the evidence for a certain kind of point? That's called a paradigm. In other words, a larger framework that's partially ideological, partially legal, partially theoretical. And Patterson's article operates from a very clear paradigm that is not contested, or that the editors of the Maine history journal did not invite a rebuttal, if you will, to have at least some sort of balancing of a perspective on the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act that would offer another paradigm, how to interpret and how to see what actually happened. Because in your broadcasting, Donna, your Wabanaki Window show, as we have talked about before, you're offering the public a window on these historical issues that most of your public is unaware of. And many Native people are feeling sometimes that certain things are wrong, but can't put their finger necessarily on it because it takes a lot of time to actually understand the levers of power that were played in the lobby, right? Behind the scenes, with the curtains closed and the door closed. We've seen that with these numerous other cases that you brought up in the course of the last year or two regarding all these discussions about sovereignty.
Yeah, no, and I think So I thought this was the case, and I was just looking it up. So their last year during the sovereignty debates, Patterson wrote an editorial for the Portland Press Herald, right, urging people to not be fooled by us Indians. I mean, I actually had drafted a response. I never actually sent it in, but in terms of a response to his editorial, but basically he calls for, basically he questions whether any rights that we don't have that other Indian tribes have, and he says that it, we should concentrate on negotiating with the governor, sort of again like point by point, and ultimately means negotiating with ourselves. But I do find that, he has been, continues to have a public role, I guess, or insert himself into the debates even as recently as last year, based upon his experience, and still arguing against, although not quite in the same way, but kind of, I think he articulated what we could say would be the governor's position in his editorial, which was that we're not so sure there are anything that the tribes can't access or don't have. This was even after the Harvard report, which he dismissed as being suspicious. He didn't take it on directly. He just said it was suspicious because it was commissioned by the Wabanaki Alliance to do the report. But I mean, that's just muckraking. Like, if you can't sort of attack the the points of the thing, to attack the authors in some way, right? But I think, it's an which is actually not what we're doing, which is the opposite of what we're doing. We didn't say John Patterson was a shill for the state. We attacked the ideas in his article, right? I think I do think it's that interesting, like, understanding and perpetuation of that understanding by certain people in the state that the Settlement Act was an enhancement of our sovereignty, that the state of Maine somehow sacrificed all this stuff, during the, like, you hear reporters, right? And they can't even tell you, like, I mean, Donna, you and I have been talking about how to deal with reporters for more than a decade. It's kind of like, when they ask me a question like, oh, what, something about how the state, lost and something during the Settlement Act, and I'll be like, well, how do you know that? Like, who told you that? And they can't even, but, well, it was a settlement, right? So does that mean all the parties had to give up something and blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, well, tell me what you think the state gave up. Like, I mean, I'm not trying to be a difficult person, but they come in just presuming that a claim against the state, right, in terms of it controlling our lands, our resources, let alone, and taking them illegally through these treaties, and then through fraudulent means, since the state it came into play, but they have somehow won this, I don't know, misrepresentational history game, even with some of the reporters that we work with, that the state gave up something, that the tribes, maybe they gained something, but also gave up something, that, it's one of those agreements where we all lost and we all won, or whatever, so how people try to both sides it, right, in these situations. And by perpetuating, this idea, Patterson and others, right, get to portray the state as victim, somehow, and that they were acting in accordance with law, in accordance with the dictates of the times, as opposed to, as we've shown since the 1830s onward. I mean, since the 1820s, really, but in the 1830s, the seizure of the four township. We could go over all the various nefarious and fraudulent means that the state put on top of these illegal treaties and just make a claim towards those things. Or, what in our one of our readings, remember when they're like, Well, we made a mistake there. Let's just count that as a no interest loan for the last 80 years, right? Remember that whole thing? They're like, oh yeah, I found this case. And then he was afraid to go into more situations. He's like, I couldn't go into any more of the history of how many times we had done this. And so he didn't even research it, remember, and that kind of thing. So that idea that the state continues to play sort of innocent in the role of taker, and that is supported by, I think, these kinds of positions, right? Which is to say, we have a fear of this thing, and we'll move the goalposts. They weren't using all that acreage anyway. You know, like coming up with just total crazy claims, which again, in the state data thing, they kind of piece him out, like including this reimagining of the State v. Newell case, where they where the state of Maine. That's what's great about State v. Dana is that it looks at the state of Maine's position around hunting rights in the 1890s and says, there is no proposition that says they can no longer, you know, wage war as something that is tied to the rights of Indian tribes. Like they're like they just make this up whole cloth just to seize it. So that's what the court said in State v. Dana. Anyway, I think that is fundamental, right? This sort of willful or I'm not even gonna say willful ignorance. It's like this willful misrepresentation of kind of the reality of the situation.
What came to mind, and this is what Darren was just referring to, and that referred to the article that we are discussing by Patterson, John Patterson, and that was somehow casting a doubt on proper land use by a few hundred people of a large drainage area, in this case, the Penobscot River drainage area or the Passamaquoddy-St. Croix drainage area. And this is ironic because he doesn't bring up the fact that one man, an absentee landowner in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, named by the name of William Bingham, who was a war profiteer, that's how he became very wealthy during the Revolutionary War, that he purchased 1 million acres east of the Penobscot and another 1 million acres on the upper Kennebec, 2 million acres owned legally, right, purchased. Sold by the state of Massachusetts to this banker in Philadelphia, the fact that that land use, land ownership owned by one single individual is not brought to bear when an indigenous nation that has hunted, trapped, and fished in their ancestral territories and have been reduced to a 400, 600 people per community as a result of genocidal war and diseases, that somehow their claim to ancestral lands is questionable. But not questionable is the ownership claim by a millionaire banker in Philadelphia who purchases from the state of Massachusetts that acreage, 1 million acres in Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribal lands. So it's an outrageous misrepresentation of the past and illustrates the paradigm that is completely colonial, as we said before, or I said before. And that is the decolonization that needs to happen for people to understand what really happened in the past in order to know what to do about current challenges facing Native nations.
Okay, well, thank you. I want to thank Professors Harold Prince and Darren Ranko for being on the show today. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Abenaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from the CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and John Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.